Velkommen tilbake til Kaptare podcast. En regntung dag i Oslo. Slutten april, endelig kom det regn. Tilfeldigvis den dagen skolen begynte for min yngste datter. Uansett, hun var godt skodd hun. Naturen har gått av dette, det har vært mye fint vær. Herlig det, hvor masse folk har hengt rundt i parker og så videre. Men vi trenger litt regn, skylle bort litt støv, litt pollen fra alle disse bjørketrærne som mange sliter med allergier og så videre. Nå har jeg snakket med en løper fra New York i USA. Jeg kom over henne via, jeg husker ikke engang, men sånn er det med sosiale medier. Når du begynner å titte litt på Instagram og blad, så plutselig ser du noen interessante, og så lager hun egen podcast. Hun skriver, hennes navn er Lucy Beatrix. Hun er en løper som debuterte på maraton i fjor, 2019, slutten av 2019, for å prøve å kvalifisere seg til Olympic Trials, som er dette løpet som arrangeres for å plukke ut de tre som skal stille i OL. Som vi vet så blir det ikke noe OL i år, dessverre. Nå er det jo utsatt EM også, så det skjer ingenting stort i år. Men uansett, hun forteller litt om sin bakgrunn, veien til løpingen som tilfeldigvis ble initiert gjennom en naturkatastrofe som preget New York på den tiden, orkanen Sandy. Hun har jobbet som modell hele sitt voksne liv. Hun er rett over 30, så vidt jeg vet. Hun har levd livet der i New York og opplevd det. Opp- og nedturer, snakker litt om sine utfordringer knyttet til alkohol, som hun har sluttet å drikke. Og det var veldig interessant og gøy for meg å snakke med noen som var et helt annet sted for en gangs skyld. Hvis vi først skal kontakte noen gjennom FaceTime og alle disse tingene som vi gjør nå for å gjøre et intervju, så tenkte jeg det var like greit at det skjedde et helt annet sted. Egentlig fantastisk hvordan vi kan bare knytte oss i rom så effektivt som vi kan nå. Det var litt utfordringer å finne ut av. Jeg har gjort opptak før over telefon, men da har det vært over telefonen. Bare lyd, nå gjorde vi det på video, FaceTime. Så det var en del ting som måtte klaffe der. Blant annet så fikk jeg henne til å spille inn lyden på sin side, sånn at vi skulle få god kvalitet. Det er jeg ganske opptatt av. Det er derfor jeg ikke er så glad i å ringe opp noen, så det blir litt sånn. Det blir ofte litt dårlig lyd der. Så denne gangen var jeg opptatt av å få god lyd. Det hadde sine utfordringer, for når hun sendte meg lydfila, så klarte ikke den å synke perfekt med lydopptaket jeg hadde på min side. Men dette har jeg jobbet med i dag, dette har jeg funnet ut av. Det er jo derfor dere som er Patreons betaler meg, for at jeg skal gjøre en innsats for at det blir en bra podcast. Så igjen, takk til alle Patreons, nye som har kommet til. Takk for det. Hvis du har lyst til å støtte podcasten, så er det bare å slå opp i podcastnotatene og finne linken nederst der. Det setter jeg enorm pris på, det vet dere. Det holder dette prosjektet gående inntil videre. Så nå skal dere få høre praten med Lucy, som jeg gjorde nå rett før helgen. Og så får dere ha en god lyttings. Håper alt går bra der ute med alle. Det har skjedd ting sakte, men sikkert. Pass på dere selv og alle fortsatt, uansett i denne smått absurde situasjonen. Ha en god, god dag videre. Hello, Lucy Beatrix. Is that correctly pronounced,
by the way? Yes, yeah. It's Lucy Beatrix, yeah.
Beatrix, yeah. Yeah, you need to have the push on the Beatrix. So you're right now sitting in front of me, but of course you're not. You're in New York City or Brooklyn, mm-hmm. Is that correct?
Yes, yeah. In Brooklyn, yeah.
In Brooklyn, in Williamsburg, I believe.
Yes.
Yes. As we spoke on the phone the other day, I've been there a few years ago, had some family living there.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
It's kind of the epicenter. It's the center of the universe, in my opinion, because it's where everything's happening in New York City. People kind of migrated out of Manhattan in the early 2000s, and all like the cool kids went to Williamsburg. And that's when I made the transition over. Living in a loft that now is in on one of the busiest streets in Williamsburg. If you know Williamsburg, you probably know the Apple store. But that big store that on Bedford Avenue is where I was living with a bunch of other people, musicians, artists, all kinds of crazy stuff was going down in that building way before it was bought out by Apple. Yeah. But yeah, that's the Williamsburg that I know. And it's definitely developed into more of like a family place to be.
It has. Yeah.
Yeah. It's for like, it's for a lot more like of the wealthier people now. Yeah. But when I moved in, it was a lot more affordable. And so luckily there's still some of that there, but it's kind of like taken over.
Which year was that you moved to Williamsburg?
I moved to Williamsburg in 2010.
Yeah.
Yeah, and there was already kind of an established scene with like the coffee shops and stuff like happening. Like it was an up and coming place, but it was still rough around the edges. Like it was still pretty industrial then.
Yeah, I was there right after that. Like
oh, cool. Yeah, so you know it then.
Yeah, 2011, 2012, I guess. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah,
they had
it was
American
so cool.
apparel stores then.
Yes. Yeah, and that's not there anymore.
It's not there. He messed it up. No. They went bankrupt.
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah,
yeah.
That's another story. But great. The reason you're on the podcast, you're a runner. That's our alibi on the podcast. If you run, you can come on the podcast. But you do a lot of stuff, as far as I know. You're a podcast yourself.
Yes.
Yeah. Just your model, as far as I understand. You're a writer. You have a blog, mm-hmm. you have a web page, you write for different stuff. And now you do some preparations for some still life for photographers.
Yes.
So you work with that.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
So, and you're a Viking.
And I'm a Viking. And you being in Norway, you probably know a lot about the Vikings.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But yeah, that's something that's kind of a funny story where when my family started learning about our ancestry a few years ago, they discovered that we happened to be related to the first Viking king of Denmark named King Norm. Mm-hmm. And so when we made that discovery, it's on my mom's dad's side. My grandpa, we kind of ran with it, and like literally it just became like, okay, we're the Vikings. It makes so much sense now why we are the way we are, because we're kind of like known for being very strong-willed people, my entire family. And so personally it really resonated with me, where I'm like, yeah, like I'm a Viking princess, I'm a Viking warrior, and this makes so much sense of like why I've done all these crazy things athletically. And I don't know, it made sense to me, and that's like where I came, I made my whole persona from. But yeah, but I mean, a lot of people descend from the Vikings, so it's not like the most unusual thing, but I don't know, it made sense for me.
you certainly look very Nordic. Definitely.
Yeah, people say that a lot.
yeah you could, if you walked on the street in Oslo, you would be taken for Norwegian, I guess. And Norwegians and Danish people are very similar.
Right, yeah.
Scandinavians, as you say. Sometimes mm-hmm. I think that Americans think that Scandinavia is the country.
Yeah, they don't know the difference.
No.
It's true.
It's three different countries, but of course we almost have the same languages and culture and everything. So we're pretty similar, but we are three countries.
Yeah,
Norway
no,
being
I
the
know.
Smallest, yeah, and furthest north. But So, do you know anything about when your family came from Denmark or anything?
Well,
do you know the story back? Or
I don't know so much. I just know that that's like way far back there. But other than that, I know way more about my dad's side, which has nothing to do with the Viking side, because my dad was Polish, and his family came from Poland and moved to New York City and were like immigrants in the Lower East Side in the 40s. And so my grandpa grew up on the Lower East Side, really poor, but knew New York like the back of his hand. And so I feel like it's kind of cool that I came back to New York when I was a teenager, because my grandfather was originally from there. Mm-hmm. So yeah, the Polish side I know a little bit more about, but as far as the Viking side, I just pretty much know like straight back to like thousands of years.
Yeah. They go back. Isn't there a TV series called Vikings?
I think they should do a real a reality show, the real Vikings, and then follow people like me.
Yeah.
There's not a lot of Viking culture left, I guess, in Norway. It's like, I guess Norwegians are pretty getting more and more like continental Europeans, especially here in Oslo. But can't you tell us a little bit about your background? You said you're not from New York City originally. You came from another city.
From St. Louis, Missouri. So the U.S. is really big, as you know, and there's a lot of different states. And so in the very center in Missouri, a lot of people don't know where Missouri is if they're from Europe. But
how far south is Missouri?
It's actually right in the center. So it's the dividing border between north and south. Uh-huh. And there's a road that goes straight through the center of Missouri that I basically grew up on. It's like the Mason-Dixon line, which divided the north and the south. And so it's smack dab in the middle of the country. And the city that I'm from is called St. Louis. Mm-hmm. And I was born and raised there, went to a boarding school where I happened to be a day student. My mom worked at the school. Mm-hmm. And so it was when I was in high school that I actually had this opportunity to move to New York City and started coming here for work, and then ultimately made the move right when I graduated. And that's when I came to New York. So in 2007, when I was 18 years old.
So you went to high school? No, school?
I went to I finished high school, but I had started my career when I was a teenager. And when I was 16, that's when I started working outside of St. Louis, like in Chicago and doing jobs around the Midwest. Mm-hmm. And ultimately, I went to Europe when I was still a teenager and started working overseas. And then that's what kind of led me down the path, long and winding, to move to New York City, which was like the epicenter of where my career was, which is as a fashion model. So basically, in the modeling industry, there's a lot of different markets all over the world. And you basically work your way up to one of the bigger markets, which in my case happened to be New York City, given I was in the United States.
Yeah.
But yeah.
How did you get into modeling? Was that by chance?
So I was working in a gift shop, just a random little shop right by my high school. And this lady came in and saw me and took a couple pictures of me and sent them to someone she knew. And after a couple of weeks, I was entering. There was this couple that was really known for scouting and discovering models. They had discovered Ashton Kutcher and different faces that people knew. And they told me to enter their little modeling contest. And after they met me, and at that contest, that's where bigger agents at these bigger agencies in different cities saw me and then signed me and brought me to their agencies in their cities. Mm-hmm. But so that was all when I was 16 years old.
That's pretty early. How was that? How was that at the time? Was that like a big thing, or did you?
I think that emotionally, I think I was ready emotionally because I had already felt like there was more out there in the world. By that point in my life, I was like, I want to get out of St. Louis. Like I didn't feel like I belonged there. And so this just was the fastest, easiest way to get out of the city that I was in. And I knew that my parents were relaxed enough that they would let me just go. And luckily they did. And looking back, I still can't believe I did some of the things I did going overseas to work and stuff when I was still in high school. But yeah, my parents let me go and start working. And thanks to that, I could actually build up like a portfolio and be able to go to New York City when I did and get a head start. And so, yeah, it's kind of strange to start so early. But at the same time, I feel like I was equipped. I just had to learn fast on my feet how the world worked.
But when you say overseas, do you mean Europe? You went to Europe?
Yeah, Greece. I went to Greece and I went to Italy and just basically with no concept of what anything was going to be like, I just jumped right in. They put me in a model's apartment and had me start working as soon as I landed, basically. Yeah. And so, yeah.
Yeah. Were you taken good care of? Was it like...
It's kind of strange.
Or was it a bit like you're a model, do the work, shut up?
It was kind of like they expect you to just know what you're supposed to do. And it is straightforward, like what you're doing is you're just going on go-sees or castings and you're meeting people and then they're going to hire you for their shoots or whatever within a few days. And That made sense, but there it was just more like the logistics of getting around, where you had to just figure out the subway in a brand new country, in a place you, in a language you don't know, right off the bat. But what I would do is just cling to people I was in the models apartments with and just follow them. And like, I'd see, okay, we have the same castings, I'll just go with you. And even if I didn't speak the same language as this like Russian model in my room with me, I would be like, hey, and just follow her. And I'm sure I was really annoying, but that's the way I, that's the only way I knew how to do it.
Yeah, only way to learn.
So, but how did you get into to running?
When was the start of that?
It's kind of crazy because I was never an athlete in high school or anything. I did no sports, but because I actually couldn't be on a team because I was traveling for work. So there was no way I could commit to practice and games and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't really have a desire for it anyway. So like, I just didn't feel like I was much of a, an athlete at all. But then when I moved to New York City, I happened to stumble upon this yoga studio that was handing out flyers outside of Whole Foods, the grocery store that I go to. And they were like, they're like, hey, come try a free class at this studio. And so from there, I started practicing yoga every single day. I was just so dedicated because it was the first time that I was doing something with my body physically and feeling like, oh, okay, like I'm not like I'm able to keep up and do the, do this kind of exercise. It was the first time I really exercised in my life. But then after becoming a yoga teacher a few years later, I got really deep into the practice and I was like pretty obsessive with it, like practicing 2 to 3 hours a day and getting into like the scripture and learning everything I could about yoga, that suddenly our studio got it got closed down because of the big hurricane that came in 2012, Hurricane Sandy. And it was the first time that I didn't have a studio to go practice at. And I was like, okay, well, I'll just go do something I don't usually do, which is go on a run. And I jumped on the treadmill that was in the building that I was living in. And they had a gym and just said, okay, I'm just going to try to run as far as I can and see where that leads me. And before I knew it, I had run 10 miles. And I was like, okay, if I can run 10 miles, that's like, it like opened up a whole new door of possibility for me.
And you had no running experience from before? Like from you were a child or you didn't do any track and field stuff or anything?
I didn't do any track and field or anything like that. But there was a track behind my house when I was a kid. There was a track at a local high school. And I would occasionally go there when I was like 7 years old and just run around it. But like nothing serious and no like organized running of any kind. But other than that, like there were a few times over the years that I would maybe try to go on a jog or something, but it just didn't speak to me the way it did when the whole city was shut down during Hurricane Sandy, when I was like, okay, like I can run for 10 miles straight without stopping. And in my head, that sort of was a lightning, like a light switch turned on where I'm like, okay, if I can run 10 miles without stopping, I'm going to try to do that every single day. And that's when it became like this whole other thing, opening Pandora's box of like, I'm going to run 10 miles a day. And then I'm going to get it down to running 10 miles in an hour every day. So like that took several years, but like I did it. And then when I did that, I'm like, okay, I'm going to run a race. And then I ran my first race and came in the top 10. And then I like started winning races. And so it kind of like, it went down, I went down the rabbit hole with running. And I feel like it was all because of that weird hurricane that blew through the city and forced me out of my yoga studio.
Yeah, yeah. It's like an act of faith or what you call it. But I guess this took a few years because even though you could run 10 miles on the treadmill, I guess you had to start your training. Or were you interested in figuring out how to train yourself? Or was it just like, no, I'm just going to go out, run and see how I feel and figure it out along the way? Or did you do some research on, you know, with books or did you know anyone or did you join a club or?
I listened to a lot of audiobooks, and I listened to when I would run. So I listened to Scott Jurek's Eat and Run. Yeah. I listened to Ritual Finding Ultra. I actually read because I don't think he has an audiobook. He might now, but back then it was just But back then it was just the actual physical book. But I listened to What I Talk About When I Talk About Running, that one book by the Japanese runner, and I just got really into like that kind of running, like nothing like that's a totally different world. Like those are more ultra guys,
yeah.
But I didn't ever get into any of the like more precise type technical type thing, no. Training, track and field type stuff at all.
No, but I know there are a lot of those books are more about stories about how they become runners and how they view it and everything.
And I liked the mentality. Like if there was something that initially really made me feel like, okay, I understand the mentality behind the ultra community, even though I was better at like not necessarily ultra, but like running 10 miles is not anything close to ultra. But having that just run, just go out there and run and don't care about times, because I didn't wear a watch, I wasn't interested in any of that kind of stuff, and really just went by feel most of the time. And it was only until way down the line when I started running races that I started to see, okay, there is a whole community of people who actually do train and do organized track workouts and stuff. And only started doing organized track workouts last year, which was leading up to my first marathon last winter.
So that took a couple of years. But before we get to that, because I know you've done a marathon, at some point, I guess it got a little more serious. When did that happen? I know that you joined a project with Nike called Nike Moonshot.
Yes.
But did it get serious a little bit before that? When did you start to wear a watch and think about miles per what do you say? The mileage. No, what do you call it? The pace. The mileage pace.
Yeah, the pace. I would say in like 2014 actually it was 2015 that was, I think, was the first time I cracked 10 miles in an hour. And I was just doing these insane runs where I was like, I was on fire, and I'd post about it on Facebook, but nobody, like my friends, nobody was really like knowing what the difference between a 6 minute mile and an 8 minute mile was. But it was finally when I had posted one of these runs that my sister had signed me up for New York Roadrunners, the racing community here. She signed me up for a membership and was like, you have to run a half marathon. If you can run 10 miles, you can run 13 miles in a race. And that was the first time that other people saw what I was capable of. And like, that was the race that I came in eighth out of 7,500 runners. And so I was in the top 10 and I had no team affiliation or anything. And I had run a 1:23, which is like a 6:22 minute mile average on like the hilly Central Park course. And so that's when a coach from a local team who had run at Princeton, he came, he introduced himself to me and was like, hey, I'm a coach and I really think you could really do some damage if you actually trained for something. So, and that was like, the first time somebody.
Meaning that you could do some damage.
Yeah.
Meaning do some good damage.
Yeah, exactly. Slang. He was the person who introduced me to the running community and teams, and kind of took me under his wing and started showing me different workouts and stuff like, oh, you can go to the track and do this and that. But in the first year of knowing him, I was really resistant and was like, I don't want to do this stuff. Like I hated the idea of going to the track to do a workout because I just didn't like that it was so different from the way I had been running. And actually, we butt heads quite a bit where he would send me a workout and ask me if I did it and I would lie and be like, yeah, it was great. But then he would want to know what the times were. And I was like, oh, I didn't wear my watch. And so he knew I wasn't actually doing stuff.
Why didn't you want to do these things? Were they like awkward to just put, you know, suddenly have a formula or a
And I didn't like the idea. I just didn't like the idea of stopping during a workout. Like I thought, oh, all this time, my whole thing was like, once I start, I don't stop. I run the entire way through. Even now, I still get funny about stopping. Like I'll try to do like a jog or something. When it says rest, I try to like keep moving somehow.
And, I think that's good though. I think that's good.
Yeah. And people do that. But I think in the beginning when he would assign these workouts of like 10 by 400 meters with 90 seconds rest, I was like, I don't want to do 90 seconds rest. If I'm going to start, I'm going to keep going. And then I would burn out too quickly, and so I didn't understand the track workout stuff at all in the beginning. But it was only until I was doing it with other people and training with a team and having Nike Moonshot and like understanding it from the inside out that I could get behind it. But
so when did the Nike Moonshot thing happen? That was like last year or something, wasn't it?
Exactly a year ago was when I applied. It was almost exactly, I think it was a little bit I think it was like last May. I applied to be part of Project Moonshot, and got in, and then
because
that
this,
was
the, it's a limited amount of runners that can enter. Mm-hmm. And how do you did you come over that, or how did you figure out?
So there was a there's a runner named Allie Kiefer who's pretty famous. She's a women's runner who had run a 227 marathon on the New York course, which is unreal because it's just such a hard course.
Yeah.
And she had this was in I think she ran that in 2017. It might have been 2018, but I think it was 2017. But anyway, so she ran this crazy race and nobody really knew who she was. Like she was a good runner and she'd run some races, but like that was really what took her to the next level.
Mm.
And when people asked her what's your secret? How did you get here? She said she'd been training with Nike Project Moonshot. Mm. And so that's how I had heard about the program. And when I saw they were taking applications, I just jumped right in and said, I really want to do this. And I had just won a half marathon in New Hampshire. It was really like a really insane course. It was a few days before I applied. So I was like, hey, I just won this weight race. And I really think I have a chance at doing really well in the marathon based on my half marathon. And yeah, and I got accepted. And it was like that really just changed everything with my perspective of running.
And that's a project that goes towards the marathon distance, or are there like different? Yeah, so that's for runners who want to achieve a marathon. Yeah,
yeah, it's but, like it's basically the premise is that you go for your moonshot goal, like your out there goal that has to do with the marathon. And I my goal was to qualify for the Olympic trials, and so I was like, that's my out there goal, and that was what I was working on that entire time I was training with them.
Yeah, but before we talk about your marathon, prior to that half marathons and 10Ks and different 5Ks and stuff, did you did you like plan them, or did you just jump in when you felt like it, or did you put specific training into anything, or how did you pick your races?
I would I was actually not racing very frequently. Like I did that first race that got me noticed from that coach James Chu, and then he wanted me to do a bunch of other races right afterwards, and it was right after I did a 10k. I did a 10k like a month after that, and it was an okay 10k. I think I ran like a 38 something, and then so like a 6:18 pace. But then a month after that I ran another 10k on the track, and it was in Philadelphia, where I happened to come in second place at this USATF Club National Track event, which was out of nowhere, but it was really fun. I'm so happy that he forced me into this race, or told me to do this race, because I got a really cool medal.
That was on a 400 meter track, like 25 laps.
Like
so what we call 10,000 meter thing.
Exactly. Yeah. So it's a 10,000 meter track event, which it was like 100 degrees. Wow. It was insane. It was at like 5 o'clock in the evening. So it was like a weird time of day.
Yeah.
But that also was really good for visibility, because it was a USATF event. Mm. And I felt like it was the first time I had raced on a track. So, you know, a lot of things came out of that that made me go, okay, there's something here. Mm. It wasn't necessarily like my best time, but that's because it was super hot. And I was actually already starting to feel some of the stress fracture injury that was coming on in my shin during the race.
Mm.
But that said, I'm still glad I did it. And I got that under my belt early on. And but yeah, so James had me do a bunch of races right in the beginning. But then I pulled back because I started getting hurt out of nowhere, like constantly after not having any injuries for years. When the races came in the picture, that's when I just started getting hurt and had to completely start over and start from scratch. It took about a year of realizing this, of like, okay, races, racing too much, having too much on the agenda is putting me in this compromised position where maybe I'm training too hard and trying to prove myself. And so, yeah, I had to like pull back and not do so many races.
What kind of amounts of or mileage did you have per week at that period? Like
in when I was getting injured a lot, well, in my mind, on my own, before James, I was running about 70 to 80 miles a week. I'd say I run like 10 to 12 miles a day. That was like just my go-to thing.
Yeah.
But then when I was training with him, I think I was trying to keep the same mileage, but I was doing a lot more aggressive, shorter burst, like harder workouts. And I think with the harder workouts and trying to keep the same mileage, it just my body freaked out and I burned out really quickly.
Yeah.
But that's where I learned, you know, later on down the line, I learned this in hindsight, is like, you can't do two hard days in a row. Like, that's just like, that's what it boils down to, is like, you just can't. And if you do, it's going to destroy your body, or at least for me.
Yeah.
So I learned that, and that's what had put my racing on hold for a really long time after that initial excitement of like, okay, I can race now. And then I had to stop for a while. And then it was only a year ago that I did that half marathon. Mm-hmm. I did a half marathon. I was like, okay, I can do this again. And that's when Nike kind of came in the picture, and I learned so much. And I'm like, I can't even believe, I feel like I learned like years and years and years of worth of running knowledge from training with them.
So what happened is that, they have a team or a trainer, or and you meet up and have track workouts. And,
so basically it becomes your life. Like, once you start with Project Moonshot, at least this is what it was like for us last year. I don't know how it's going to be. I don't know, with everything going on in the world, I don't know when they're going to do another one. But basically they take you under their wing and they say, this is the training plan, and this is the paces you should be running on these days. And then 3 days a week, you're meeting up with the coach for the workouts. You have three workouts a week, and you meet up with coaches, and you're training with your pace group, and on the track, and you're doing like everything with them. And even on days that are recovery days, where you're not necessarily, you're not supposed to be with the moonshot people, you meet up with your friends that happen to be in the same pace group with you. So you're around the same runners with the same goal all the time, and your whole life kind of can be becomes running.
Yeah.
And they even took us away to it, like a little camp where we were staying at this college campus and just trail running and track running and learning about nutrition and everything. So it was like a full immersive running camp thing.
That's pretty awesome to be picked out for a project like that. I saw that.
It was amazing.
Yeah, I saw also when I read your on your website, you also joined another club.
Yeah, Brooklyn Track Club. Yeah. Yeah. So the same people who are behind Project Moonshot, they're not affiliated. Like, it's not the same thing. But like the head coach of Project Moonshot happens to have a team that goes full year round. That's not just marathon training. Mm. But he has this team called Brooklyn Track Club. Mm. And his name is Steve Finley. And he and his partner started this team a couple of years ago. And once I was on Project Moonshot and I was around all these Brooklyn Track Club teammates, I was like, oh, okay, I really want to be on this team too when Project Moonshot's over. So at the same time, I joined Brooklyn Track Club. And that was also a big game changer, because I was like, these are my people. Like, these people get it. And I felt like I really belonged on that team.
Yeah. So does Nike do a lot of these projects around the US, or was this just
I think they just specific? They started doing more. So they did Project Moonshot for a few years, and then this year they were trying to do something called Project Fearless, which was just for the half marathon. But that, I think, got, it might have been canceled because of the all the races started getting canceled. So but I think they're trying to change it so it can be different distances and not just the marathon.
Yeah.
But yeah,
because Nike is now pretty famous for their shoe, for the Breaking 2 project, which was started way back.
Cool.
I know, because I there's a book by something I've talked about it on the podcast before, called 2 Hours, which is about the start of trying to break the 2 hours and is it possible and blah blah blah.
Yeah.
But no one had, they had been looking at a lot of, is the body physically able to run under 2 hours? And maybe, but it'll happen in 2049.
So many people didn't think it was possible. Yeah, yeah. No, it's
but
amazing.
But then the shoe, right? So there's been a lot of talk about the shoe and so forth. And I guess things have happened now that they have to, there's a limit to how thick the sole and so forth. But I guess, of course, you run in Nike shoes because sponsored by them. And are you still under their wing, or is it the project ended now? Or
so when you're training with Project Moonshot, it's not like you're technically sponsored or anything. Like, you don't have to wear Nike stuff, but you like, because they're showing you. Like, it's like I just wore Nike because I was like, okay, well, like it just made sense to. But it's not a requirement or anything. But I felt like I wanted to train in the Nike shoes, and I wanted to wear the Next Percents for my marathon and they were great for me. Some people, they don't work for them. So it just so happened that because my trainers are the Pegasus Turbo shoes and I just happened to fit like they fit my feet well, that I'm like, I like these shoes anyway. But then training with them also, it they went together. It wasn't like I was forced to wear them or anything, but I wanted to wear them.
But I would presume that when you're in this project, they give you a pair of shoes or a couple of pair of shoes.
So they had done that in the past. Yeah. They had done that in the previous Project Moonshots, but they didn't do it this past year. I'm not exactly sure why, but I think... I think there was a very handful, select few who did get some, but no, I mean, we had other perks like discounts and stuff that made it so that we could get Nike stuff for like a deal. But they didn't give us a pair of shoes.
They probably can afford it.
Yeah.
I would call them up and say, hey, Nike, can you?
Hey.
Yeah. Provide me with a couple of shoes. Yeah. But anyway, then you had a marathon that you had settled on at the time when you started the Project Moonshot. There was a specific marathon you want to run. Which one was that?
The California International Marathon, which was the latest marathon on the 2019 race schedule. So most people who did Project Moonshot, they were training for the New York Marathon. Mm-hmm. And then some people were training for the Chicago Marathon, Berlin, and so on throughout the fall. Mm-hmm. Philly was right before CIM. But then I did the one that was the last race of the year. That was going to be my one shot. And I chose it because the course was the most favorable for a time qualifying time. It's the fastest course basically that I could have chosen that I could get into. Mm-hmm. And so I had settled on CIM like way before. So like last spring I had already signed up and registered for it. And it was actually because I had deferred from the previous year because I was set to run CIM in 2018, but mm-hmm. I was injured. So I had to defer. And so I already had the registration. I was like, right, good to go for over a year. And so that was the race that I was working towards.
Mm. I've only heard of it because of I followed you on Instagram and I saw that race, but it's not that big of a marathon, is it? Or how many
starters? It's getting bigger. I don't know how many. There were a lot this year because everyone was trying to qualify for the Olympic trials, and it's kind of like the course for that, for the time, for getting your time. And that said, I thought it was going to be a really flat course, and it wasn't at all. It was extremely hilly. Oh. Yeah, it was really, really hilly, and it was unexpectedly, like, I was expecting it to be a lot more mild, but it was, there was a lot of up and down.
Yeah.
And I would definitely do it again, though.
Yeah, yeah. But how come, but it's a fast course, even though it's hilly, or is it famous for being a fast course?
It is fast because, I think it's a fast course because it's a net downhill, but that doesn't mean that it's necessarily downhill. It's like, it's maybe a little bit more downhills than uphills, but like the uphills were significant. And you would like at the halfway point, at like the 13.1 mile point, the uphill was crazy. And I was like, okay, this is not a downhill course.
So it's one long run like this. It's not a loop. Because that much I know that you need a loop for it to be a world record.
Interesting.
Yeah, that's why. Or am I bullshitting now? Yeah, I think so.
So that sounds right.
I think to have a world record, I think it needs to be a loop. So there's no net downhill. Or that's why Boston can't be a official world record.
Interesting.
Yeah, because Boston starts somewhere and ends, you know, somewhere else.
Oh, interesting.
I might be wrong, but I think this is true because, of course, the world record is often set in Berlin, which is a loop. Very flat one. So, but
a lot of people.
Yeah, New York isn't the loop, is it? No. New York is not a loop. No,
because New York is not a loop.
It starts in Staten Island.
Yeah, and ends in Central Park.
Yeah,
It's a crazy course too, but I've heard. I'm supposed to do New York this year if things don't get canceled. Yeah. People are talking about that happening, but that's my goal for this year. So hopefully I get to experience that.
Yeah. October is it or October?
It's in November.
November,
like
the
November 2nd or something.
Yeah. So you had you're talking about the Olympic qualifier and you need to reach a certain time.
Yes.
For the ones of us who doesn't know too much how an Olympic qualifier works in the USA, how can you tell us a little bit about that?
So, yes, the Olympic trials qualifying time was 2:45. And so you could literally run a 2:45 marathon, 2:45:00, and you would get in. And there were people who did. Okay. Their time and they qualified. Yeah. But or below. And so my goal was to do that, like was to be at 2:45, sub 2:45. That was my goal. Mm-hmm.
That's a good, good time. Pretty far.
Yeah. But I fell short. Yeah. I wasn't a 2:45 marathoner, but at the same time, for my first marathon and giving it what I had, I think I did pretty well.
Yeah. But tell me more how it works.
You run that time on a sanctioned course, on a like a qualifying course. Yeah. And once you run it, you're a qualified Olympic trials marathoner. Mm-hmm. And then those people who qualified went to Atlanta. In last a couple of weeks ago, it was actually like a month and a half ago, was the Olympic trials, where all of those athletes then go to Atlanta and they run the Olympic trials, and the top three become the Olympian, like the Team USA marathoners. So that was my goal, was to get to the Olympic trials. I know a bunch of girls who did, and it was crazy how many there were a lot of people from New York City, from our running community who made it, including the co-founder of my team, Brooklyn Track Club. She was one of the many Olympic trial qualifiers. So I was looking up to her a lot, a lot of the time, because I was like, she's just like my hero. So I was like, okay, I want to do what she did. But so she made it to the Olympic trials and ran it. And
How many get to start? How many men and women?
Do you know? It was a lot. It was so many. I don't know exactly how many, but it was definitely in the hundreds. Yeah. Like quite a lot of people.
Do you know the time for men? What that was?
For men, it's sub 2:20. So actually, it either is sub 2:20 or 2:19. I think. Mm. I think it's sub 2:20. I don't know though for sure. It might be 2:19. But there's a runner that I follow named Sage Cannaday, and he's qualified many times. He's also a plant-based runner.
He's an ultra runner also.
Yeah. He does ultra, which is crazy that he does both. But he was trying to qualify and he didn't. He missed it by like a few seconds or something. But he's done it multiple Olympics in the past where he'd qualified for the trials. Mm. But yeah.
But tell us about, we're getting to the race. You're going to tell us about the race, but tell us a little bit, how did you specifically train? You know, you don't need to go into very much details, but they had a plan, the Nike Moonshot. You followed that, or they tweaked it for you and changed it? Or
they had a plan laid out for the marathoners of like, this is what week by week looks like. Mm. And then there's like wiggle room of like adjusting. So like if you're really tired and you see you have 3 to 5 miles for a recovery day, it can also say like, if you're too tired, take it off. Like, so like you can kind of adjust to how you feel, but then the workouts they give you, the same goes for like what pace you decide to go for given your goal. So like if I was feeling kind of burned out, I would say, okay, well maybe I won't run this at 10K pace. I'll run it at a half marathon pace or something. Or like looking back at a workout that I feel like I failed, I'd be like, oh, well no, I just gave it like a 75% effort versus 100% effort. Mm-hmm. So they give you room to make it your own. And but there was like a plan with like, these are your workouts each week. And every week we got our email of like, this is what we're doing this week. And your mileage. And so, I just went according to that plan. And then at the same time, Brooklyn Track Club had the same kind of plan laid out for us, for people who were going after the marathon. So it was like, I just worked between the two teams, between Project Moonshot and Brooklyn Track Club. I trained with both of them, trying to go towards my goal. Mm. But yeah.
So everything went fine with the training. It felt spot on and everything, and it became faster and new.
It was kind of remarkable to see things kind of fall into place, because the first few weeks of training, I just thought there's no way, like I'm just not there. And there's other people who had already, the girls that I was running with that we were supposed to be on the same pace, I'm thinking like, I'm never going to be where they are. And luckily those teammates kind of took me under their wing and they're like, no, I felt the same way. Like when I wasn't doing these kinds of specific workouts where you just feel so burned out and you're not sure you can keep up. Mm. But I learned pretty quickly that like it's kind of like math, where it's like the more you do, the more hard work you do, the more return you're going to see. And like it all comes together eventually if you just keep doing it. But in the moment, it can feel excruciatingly hard. And I just, there were times when I just like couldn't believe that I was like, I can't believe I'm running 20 miles at a 640 pace without stopping.
Yeah.
And, but looking back, I'm like, no, that's because I was in the mode, like I was in the right, I was doing my training exactly how it was being prescribed. And
So tell us about the race itself, how it was. When was it? December?
December 8th, last winter, so 2019.
In California, in Sacramento?
In California, in Sacramento. Where is that?
North? Or?
It's a little bit like north. I think it's like in between LA and San Francisco, like in the middle there.
Yeah.
It's kind of a random part of California where there's no beach. So it's like not the kind of California that I like. I knew LA, I know San Diego, I've been to San Francisco, but it's kind of a random part of California, and not really that much going on except for this race. That's what brings people there every year. But I got out there early. Like, I made it a point to be out there way earlier than when most people were going out. I think I was out there like 3 or 4 days before the race the expo opened and stuff, because I just wanted to get situated. But I don't know, I did a lot of things wrong that week. I can, like, looking back, I'm like, I think I saw my downfall coming, which is sad to say, but I did a lot of things that maybe like spent my energy too much. I wasn't sleeping very well because I was so nervous about the race. And I don't know, it wasn't the best.
How did you stay in Sacramento?
I stayed in a really amazing hotel. My mom came out. She was like, let's make this like a thing. Let's make this a vacation, because we never take vacations or anything together, especially. And so we stayed in a really nice hotel, and we kind of just got situated. I just like tried to take it really easy leading up to the race. We went to the grocery store a few times and just like stocked up on food. But I don't know, I think because it was something, I was going after something so out there. It was, I try to enjoy it, but I think I got inside my own head a little too much and freaked out.
Like very many first marathoners, I guess.
Exactly. Yeah. And I just feel like I maybe spent a little too much energy the day before freaking out, and I could have saved that. Cause I was like, what are people going to say if I fail? And like, now I look back and I'm like, I should have just enjoyed it, but I don't know.
Yeah, but I guess it's a thing you have to go through. I know it. I've only run 2 marathons, but the first was like, I was so nervous. I couldn't sleep the whole week before. And I felt, when I started the whole thing, I felt drained at the start. You know, I was like,
No, it's crazy. Well, like the magic happened for me like right before the start, like that morning when I got on the bus, got to the starting line. There I felt great. I was like, I'm here, it's gonna be beautiful, like everything felt nice. But it was just everything up until that point that I was having a panic attack, and like, I don't know, it's like, I think that my mom too, she's not from any kind of athletic background, and like, she didn't do sports or anything. She doesn't understand the culture surrounding sports or runners or any of that, and she didn't understand. She just was like, I was trying on my race kit the day before and like making sure everything like looked good and fit well and whatever, pinning my bib on and stuff. And she just didn't get like any of that. And I feel like I held that against her, and I was like, you don't understand, this is the biggest moment of my life. And like, she didn't get it. But at the same time, I'm kind of grateful she's not like a stage mom with like running. She didn't care. She was like, she doesn't know the difference between a 2:45 and a 3:45.
No,
so
right.
Yeah.
But did Nike and the trainers and everything follow you up right till the day, or did they let you go like with the tapering, or how?
So there were a few of us Project Moonshotters that were at the race, running it. A few, like a little group, my close friends, and then there was some of the trainers that had been with us in Project Moonshot were there at the race. They ran like the 5K the day before. A few just friends from the whole training process that just wanted to come see it, and so yes, some of the Project Moonshot people were there. And so it wasn't like the entire Project Moonshot people went, but some people did. So that was pretty cool.
So what, how did the race go for you? Did you have a plan about the pace? And
Did
you cut it up, or did you think, how did you do it?
I did mentally.
Yeah.
I went into it thinking, okay, 2:45, I need to be hitting for every 5K, I need to be hitting a sub 19 5K.
Yeah.
And then at the halfway point, I just wanted it to be even splits the entire time. So I was like, for the first, I wanted my first half to be 122 and then like just do it do two halves right back to back, 122 122 to get like a 244 and like, you know, give or take to be underneath 245.
And you had run a 122 half marathon, a 123?
I had run a 123. That was my PR for the half, but that was also like on such a strenuous course that I kind of thought, well, maybe, like, I don't know. I that was just what I thought. I thought I had it in me to do a 122 twice. But given like the way I had built up with my mileage, because my long runs were indicators that like this was in my legs. Like I was looking at my data on Strava and stuff and saying like, yeah, I can hold this pace. But so I had also been talking to one of the coaches from Brooklyn Track Club. She leads the sub elite women's. So she's not Project Moonshot, but she was this coach that I had been back and forth with a lot leading up until the last minute going in and running this race. And she was the first person who said to me, like, she believed in me, but she also said, you know, don't sell yourself short. If you want to have a different goal, like alongside my moonshot goal, have like another goal, it would be to break three, which is also a big thing in the running, you know, marathon. You obviously marathoners want to break three all the time. So like, she was like, those are two really great goals. And so she's like, get out there and run the race of your life. And if you find yourself slipping away from 245, make it, you know, sub three. Yeah. And so that was something I kept in mind for the last bit, because I could have easily just stopped and been like, okay, I'm not going to get this Olympic trials qualifier, so what's the point? But instead I just was like, no, I'm going to finish strong and break three and have that under my belt.
But
I'm so glad I did.
When did you notice then that you weren't going to hit the 245?
I knew it was slipping away halfway through the race. Yeah. So like the first half was great and I was exactly on pace with the pacers, going to do this. And I saw the people, like there were people even talking. I feel like there were a lot of really, with the marathon, it's so long that you have like a lot of time to kill in the beginning where you're just getting through the first couple miles. And there's a lot of extra energy because people are trying to save their energy and like, you know, not run too fast too soon. And I heard some chatter amongst some of the runners in this 245 pace group saying like, oh, okay, like, yeah, we just got to keep it easy and, you know, this is going to be great. And I thought, yeah, we're going to do this. But it was at the halfway mark that I started to slip away and like started to see these pacers kind of get a little further and further. And I'm like, why are they? I just thought like there was maybe a chance I was going to be able to catch up with them. But then it just, I don't know, it just got like weird and I couldn't move my legs fast enough. And I had missed the water stations. And so everything was like, it was becoming like messy. And I thought, no, this isn't how it's supposed to go. And no, but it just, you know, had to finish some way, somehow.
But that's a pretty good point. You missed some water stations, because that's my experience from my first marathon, just missing too much water, missing. I didn't bring gels. I was just an amateur. On the second one now, I had learned my lesson and I was like, water and gels every 5K. You know,
exactly.
Just
keep it
coming. But you missed a few of those, or in the beginning?
I missed the water, and that really caught up with me right away. And I kind of, I wrote about that a little bit on my blog, where I was like, that was my downfall. But it was because it was too crowded. Like, I didn't know which side to be on, and like, I couldn't get over. And so there was, that was the first problem. And then like taking in gel with no water, your mouth gets all like dry. And
gooey.
So, but I think I did pretty well with the nutrition, like the gels during the race. It was just the water that didn't do well.
How was the temperature while you were running?
It was perfect. Yeah. I would say, I don't know what it would be in Celsius, but it was like the perfect crisp, right amount of crisp air, but not too cold and not too hot. I had arm warmers on that I took off during the race, but it like, it was just the right, the conditions were ideal. And that's I'm like, oh man, I had everything like the stars aligned. But
But there's so many, you know, and I saw that you wrote also on your blog that you understood that it was a mind game also, because it's all the thing. How did you feel? But you said that you were readjusting. That was a good thing, I would say, that you were readjusting, that you weren't just, oh no, I'm not going to make it, so I don't want to run. But you had a new goal and then you thought, I'm going to go for that. So we're able to keep a pretty good pace.
Yeah, and I would like look at my watch and say, okay, like the last 4 miles, I was like, listen, if I can just do 7:30 pace, which I knew like I could hold on, I was like, if I can just do that, was like at that point that was kind of like my recovery pace for some of these workout runs. So I was like, if I can just hold on at that pace for the rest of this thing, I can be sub three. And so that was when I was like, I had a little bit more faith in myself that I could do something, and I'm glad I pushed it at the end. Because 2:55 ends up being like a time that qualifies you for other big races. So it like puts you in the sub elite corrals for these other big races. So I felt like at least I could get that.
Yeah.
But yeah.
So now you can get into like the New York Marathon with that time.
Yeah. Right? Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So like that time gave me open doors for qualifying for these other races now.
Yeah. So is there a new marathon? Now we don't know, of course, but is there a new one you want to run? Do you have anything planned? Or
so, yeah, we don't know about New York, but and
but that's where you want to go. You want to run New York.
That's where I want to. Yeah. That's what I'm hoping for this fall, and obviously it might be postponed till next spring. We don't know, but then since I qualified for Boston, I'm like, well, I can't not run Boston if I qualified for it. So that's going to be hopefully 2021.
Yeah,
but you know, I hope because I know that Boston's postponed now till this fall, and then don't know. So so they postponed it to September, but they don't even know if that's going to happen. But
that happened here too in Oslo. I was supposed to have three races that I was supposed to, first half marathon, then a 10K, then a 30K trail. I mean, they're all postponed. So lot happening in the fall.
Oh, yeah.
So
yeah,
many races. Yeah. I'm going to do a marathon, two marathons in the fall, actually. One like a trail one, and one. So I don't know how it's going to be, but we'll just have to keep on running, I guess.
Yeah.
But great. 2:55 is enormous for a first marathon, I would say.
Thank you. And
most people only get better.
I'm hoping. I feel like with the right conditions and knowing what I know now. Yeah. But the sky's the limit, really.
But of course, it is the training. It's a lot is done during those months prior.
Yeah.
So it seemed like you had a very good training period. So
I did. I had I feel like the training cycle was so good, and I would hope that the big thing though is like I had such a dream in my mind the entire time where I was just so excited, thinking like I could really have this, and that's what I was holding on to during all these really long hard runs. So for the next one, now that I have a little bit more experience under my belt, I think I could go into it even stronger and think like, wow, like who knows? I could even go faster than what I thought I could ever do. So. Yeah.
No, I believe so. But at the same time, you've done all this running, all this training, everything over the years. You have been working full time as a model.
Yes.
With because I looked into a few of your articles, and it seemed like there's some very long days sometimes, some very hard work.
Yeah.
And sometimes you get called in and asked, can you go tomorrow to blah, blah, that city and get up in the morning? How did all this work for you?
So that stuff, so like obviously, so my modeling career was really strong for about a decade. So like from 2007 till 2017, that was my full-time main job, like getting random calls, flying all over the world at any given moment. Yes. But then around 2017, like when I was approaching my late 20s, I took it, put it on the back burner and was focusing on other stuff, like trying to get into other professions, and worked at a production company briefly and was like doing copywriting and different kinds of jobs that were not related to modeling, because it just was, I got kind of tired of it, and it's kind of a crazy job to have for so many years. But then I like took a break from it with it for a while, and just started to explore different sides of the industry, and got into the job that I had right up until the lockdown, which was working on set as a stylist assistant and working like on the other side of the camera and like getting images ready, helping stylists prepare shoots, and working in the photo studio with still life. So with like products and stuff. So I was working at a retail company here shooting every day, which was really therapeutic for me, because I do love the environment on a set. I love studio life. Like that's where I feel the most comfortable, but I also love not being the focal point of like being the thing being shot. So,
but I guess you have a professional approach to all the being shot by photographers.
Yeah.
But how is, I don't know any models, obviously, but how is that industry? Is that, I guess it has its sunny and dark sides.
Yeah, the whole thing. That's a good way of putting it.
Yeah.
It's like both like amazing and terrifying. Mm. Like I felt like so many doors opened for me when I was so young, where I was able to live in New York City by myself and make a living and stuff. Mm. But at the same time, it was just really lonely and dark. And I don't know. It's like, it's a weird job, but at the same time, a lot of jobs are weird. And I think about people who have had all kinds of experiences that weren't fashion models. And it's like, I think that it's the kind of thing where it's like, depends on your mentality going into it. And for me, I really appreciated where it brought me, but it also wasn't necessarily the most like emotionally stimulating thing and didn't always lead me down the best paths, but I am grateful for it.
Mm. But as far as I know, and that you've been really honest about, you had your, what do you call it? Difficulties with like the dark side, the partying, alcohol, I don't know, drugs and stuff like this. Was that?
Could you tell us
a little bit about that? If you're comfortable doing it?
Oh, yeah. No, totally. I'm very open about that stuff, especially on my podcast. I talk a lot about the recovery aspect of like coming out of addiction and stuff. And it that stuff got the worst. Like I rock bottomed way after I had taken a break from modeling. So like maybe it was bad and it was kind of being managed. Like I was a functioning alcoholic for a really long time. Mm-hmm. But then it was when I took a break from my career that I could really see this is not what normal people do. And this isn't a way that people live and have a productive, happy life. Mm-hmm. So yeah, it's kind of funny that like when I had stopped modeling, I was like, you know what? I live in New York City. I want to work at a bar. And that's the kind of life I want, like a real authentic New York City existence. And that happened to be when I was drinking the most, obviously, because like working in a bar and around that culture all the time. Mm. But So
you did work in a bar for a while?
I did, yeah. And I have great memories of it. I'm glad I did that. Like it was definitely like worth the experience, but also it was a really great enabler, and I was around alcohol all the time, and I didn't have to, like, I could drink however much I wanted without having to worry like if anyone cared or anything. So yeah, that really like opened a lot of doors and like exposed me to myself of like how bad this was becoming. But yeah.
But it's pretty wild to think that you were doing this stuff and doing all the training. And so you did a lot of running and training and hard training while being hungover and
an alcoholic. Yeah. No, but some of my, it's so weird, but I've also seen it repeat. I've seen other people do this, and I've seen athletes that I would never tell them that they're an alcoholic or anything, but I've seen it happen where I'm like, wow, they went out and drank so much, but then they are able to wake up and run 22 miles. Mm. And that cycle, it seems to work, but then I feel like one day you wake up and it doesn't work. Because for me, I was doing that where I would drink, you know, a couple bottles of wine and wake up and go running off and it was fine. But then one day it just didn't work because I was injured. And then suddenly I'm like, well, how am I going to undo all of the alcohol I drank last night? Mm. But yeah, so it's like it's not a sustainable way to train.
No, I know. For me, drinking 2-3 glasses of wine, sometimes I can wake up and feel that I've done it. And it's a little bit, oh no, I have this long run and it doesn't feel good. And it's a conflict for me, even though I guess for a lot of people. But I know that also a lot of runners just don't drink anything for long periods of time if they want to be really serious with the running. But when did you realize that, okay, this is a problem, I need to stop drinking completely? Was anybody telling you, or did you realize it yourself, or how was it?
Some people had said things over the years, but things had happened out of like a drunken state or whatever, like bad stuff happened, but nothing was ever bad enough that like forced me to get sober. No. It was only until like I really fucked up and like everything, I literally lost everything in my life, like the relationship I was in, just everything kind of fell apart. And so I woke up and was like, I don't want to feel this way anymore. I can't bear to feel this way anymore. And like the uncertainty of like how I'm gonna survive like this. So that's when I like called someone I knew who was in recovery, and she basically brought me to my first AA meeting. Mm-hmm. And yeah, so then I just have been in recovery ever since.
Uh-huh. But that's, yeah, some people really have to go away and do the recovery at the clinic and stuff like that.
Yeah,
but
yeah.
You didn't do that? No.
No, I didn't have to do that. I didn't do that. I just focused on just going to meetings every day and staying connected. And like, luckily with the community, like you just like stay connected with people. And yeah, it's just like, that was like the way I could do it. And for a little bit there, I took a little break from, I stopped working at the bar pretty much that day. Like the day that I started going to meetings.
Yeah, because you have to cut your old life, I guess.
Yeah. So then I had to kind of like reassess. Yeah. And luckily with like the strength and support, that opened a lot of doors for me to like go and find this other job, and immediately found like my another place that didn't have anything to do with like alcohol or anything. Yeah. And and I actually went back with my old modeling agency at the same time. Like I called them up and was like, hey, I'm like, I'm done with this break and I want to get back into stuff. And they were like, okay, great. And they'd known me since I was a teenager. They'd known me for so long. And so they brought me back in, and it wasn't the same. It's not the same like caliber of what it was when I was younger, but it's still something. And, you know, jobs would come up and stuff. So
you still do a little bit or
before, yeah, I mean, the camera? It's weird with like the lockdown stuff now, but like I had a bunch of jobs last year that like kind of came out of nowhere, and I like it at this age now where like I have so much life experience where I can like go into jobs and know that I'm not going to be forced to do stuff that I don't want to do, because I can just say I don't want this. But yeah, so I can appreciate it, and I've made a lot more friends that I've worked with, like designers and stuff, where I'm like, because I feel like we're in the same like level of maturity, where before I was just like too young to understand stuff and I couldn't like hold really like meaningful conversations with the people I was working for. But now I feel like I'm able to become friends with the people I'm working for.
Yeah. That's very interesting. And I know that you have also written a little bit, or is interested in nutrition. And I see that you've been writing that you're a plant-based, or you're plant-based, as we say. We're based on plants.
Yeah,
and based on plants. How did you figure out everything?
It's so funny that you asked that. Because obviously our common denominator is Rich Roll.
Yeah.
And he was friends with my ex, and I was not plant-based when I met Rich, but I went to a dinner with my ex, Rich Roll, and John Joseph, who are like that's like the most vegan-y plant-based people out there, like that like speak to that movement. And so like literally sitting at a dinner with these guys, not knowing who they are, but then having this like the world kind of like put me in that, or like having it all come into full circle and be like, okay, well, these guys eat this way and they're all like ultra endurance people, and I don't know, it just like clicked for me, and I followed Rich ever since. And so it's been several years now that I've followed him and learned about that way of life and everything. And I don't know, it works for me, and I like his approach a lot, where he's really accessible, and it's not about doing it perfectly, but just like most of the time. And that's kind of the way I go about it too.
No, I think that's important, to not think that you have to do it perfectly, because there's a very, like, if you cross the line and you're plant-based and you use the word vegan, you can never go back and blah blah blah.
Right.
I think we have to relax a little bit on that and say that just try and it's possible, of course. And every other day, or two meals a day, or, because I see you wrote a little bit about plant-based, and you wrote about the ketogenic diet. That's probably very well known for a lot of people.
I tried it. It didn't work for me.
No, I don't think it works long-term, but I've never tried myself. But
It doesn't. It's not like, for athletes, it's hard, because like, you need that glycogen. And
You do. That's what you burn. And also the brain goes in glycogen.
I'm a different kind of person. I feel like it was like functioning on a lower frequency than like when I'm plant-based. But
but of course, not to talk too much about food and stuff, because there's so many opinions, but of course it's very important to just eat healthy and eat real food. And I saw that you wrote about that, and obviously in the USA there's a lot of processed foods, and for me and you listened a lot to Ritual, and he talks a lot about food, and Sid Garza Hillman that I mentioned, he's also a nutritionist, so he knows a lot. It's a little bit like that in Norway too as well now. I guess we're a lot like the States, most of Europe. So I guess eating real food is really important, you know, not being too, and especially for us that are, or I say us, but runners that need to recover. Sleep is important, food is important, and
those are the big main things for my life. It's like eating, sleeping, running. It's like they all, it all goes together.
How have you figured the sleeping part out? That's not so easy always to...
I try really hard with that. So yeah, the big thing for me, like people make fun of me, but like I wear blue light blocking glasses at sundown and don't have any blue light exposure after the sun goes down. And like that's worked for me for years. So I'm like, I swear by it.
But
that just helps with my sleep cycles.
Yeah. Tell me a little bit about that, because I heard you had a biohack podcast.
Oh yeah, yeah. I went through all kinds of biohacking stuff. Yeah.
And I recognized a few of the stuff, a few of those things, like taping your mouth with nose breathing and stuff.
Kind of crazy. Yeah.
Of course. Yeah. But I'm gonna be honest about it. I tape my mouth in the evening, and it's when I go to sleep, it's because I snore. So my wife.
Yeah.
If I don't do it, I'm probably gonna snore, and my wife is like waking me up, and I'm like, what you're snoring?
No, I wasn't. It's you were. It's a thing. That's such
but
a thing.
When I put that tape, I'm not gonna snore, and the thing is, I'm gonna sleep better also. That's
because you're supposed to sleep through your nose.
I
breathe through your nose when you sleep. I've tried a lot of the biohacks.
But tell us about the blue blocking thing, because I don't know if so many people know how that works.
So the thing is that like when the sun goes down, your body naturally, like your hormones in your body are telling you, okay, like this is time to settle down. And when you're exposing yourself to blue light, which comes from the sun, and also comes from our phones, synthetic blue light, then that will make us wake up. And so like the whole premise theory behind it is like, if you're looking at blue light from your phone right up until you go to bed, you're not releasing the hormones that are going to produce like melatonin and make you fall asleep. So then you're not getting like the adequate recovery that you need to be a really good athlete or just like a normal functioning person.
Yeah. So it's going to be harder to fall asleep if you expose yourself to too much
it's
light.
It's going
to
be harder.
Even, you know, artificial light is not too good.
Right. Same with like your fluorescent light.
Fluorescent. Also blue light. Yeah. Because as we all know, there's a spectrum. It's the blue light, and on the other side, it's the red light. So too much of the blue light indicates daylight, of course.
Exactly.
So that's the point. So when you put your glasses on, that's kind of orange, yellowish. Orange?
Yeah, they're amber tinted. Yeah. A lot of glasses on the market that are just like clear, but they say, oh, blocks blue light. They're not they're not like the enough blue light. Like it needs to block 99%. So that's why they're amber tinted, and like only those amber tinted lenses block the majority of blue light. Mm. But yeah, I wear those to like get ready for bed, like that that time of day. Like put them on, and I wear them until I go to bed. Mm. But then I also do a lot of other stuff where like I take cold showers or like try to get my body temperature down before I go to sleep to promote like a deeper like REM inducing sleep, or I wear a bandana over my eyes to make it even darker, as well as like being in a really dark room. I don't know. I try a lot of stuff, like the whole cold thermogenesis thing. I'm like, I love all that stuff, where like I was doing a ton of ice baths and crazy stuff like that, like the Wim Hof, like in the middle of the winter, just going outside in a bikini and crazy shit like that.
You still do that, or?
It hasn't like been cold enough lately, but I haven't in the past few weeks or anything, but in the middle of the winter, I was going out when it was really cold and just, you know, experiencing it.
No, I also followed Wim Hof's stuff. I'm such a pussy on the cold baths, but when I went to Bergen now on the West Coast for a few two months ago, we went and in the water. And that was really cold. Yeah, but only for like 10 seconds, but it felt really good. But
that's great.
Yeah, it's great. But what I think is when I turn on the shower, that's the tough part. You know, the cold.
Really?
Yeah, I think that's... but you need to train on it like everything.
I almost do it every single day. Like you try to cold for like at least the end of it. But yeah, I've been doing that for so long that I feel like it's like it comes second nature to me now. But
But... just before we end this, I don't know how long have we talked. We're going over an hour, but anyway, as you can see, it's dark outside here now. It's only artificial light. But we don't want to talk too much about this lockdown, and because we're so sick and tired of this thing. But how has it been to live in New York these last 2 months?
Really crazy. I don't know. Like I feel like for me, the thing I miss is just working. Like I just really want to be in the studio and I can. And like that's just, it's unnerving for me because it feels like I'm just kind of like stagnant. Mm. But so I've just been getting a lot of that energy out by going and running and focusing on these stupid virtual challenges, like the marathon I ran last week, and was like, okay, I want to go run a marathon on the track today. And
yeah, so tell us about that, because that was just a spontaneous thing.
Yeah, I just like woke up and there's like a big challenge, a global running challenge thing where like this guy puts on from the Orchard Street Runners, and he is notorious for putting on these crazy races. Mm. And so he said, you get to choose amongst all these distances from like a mile to 100 miles. Mm-hmm. Go run this and have your watch like track it. Don't stop your watch, like have the data there. And then if you can prove that you ran that, then you get to be part of like competing in like this challenge. And I decided, like, I woke up and was like, I'm gonna just go try to do a marathon today. And then I did on the track, and he said that post got a lot more traffic than usual on his Instagram, because it's kind of weird. People don't usually run marathons on the track, so like it was a weird thing, but I don't know. That was just the way to pass the day that day.
Yeah, I can actually in the show notes I can link to your podcast episode that you talk about that, because it's pretty interesting. Just going down there with half a bottle of seltzer water.
just a little bit of water.
No gels, no nutrition, no nothing.
No, nothing. You just like obviously the time was like nothing great, but it was like to do a 3:25, just knowing, okay, I can whip this out of nowhere. That's just like was a good indicator to me that there's more in the tank. And I don't know. I love that like minimal approach too.
Yeah, but there with the importance of being able to burn fat. You know, because that's what you do when you run a marathon.
Fasted. Yep.
Yeah. When you do that pace, the body just burns fat. And that's, of course, that's a part of the training we do as marathoners. When we go on the long, slow runs, it's just to teach the body to use more than the glycogen, which is limited, right? Yeah. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But how was it mentally to just go 105 laps, 105.5 or something?
Yeah. 105.5. I just tuned out and thought about all kinds of stuff. Well, because I'm I have a lot of chatter in my head about like what's going on in the world, and it's like really unsettling, but that was just like the way to not have to think about all that stuff and do something kind of fun and different. And I don't know, I'm pretty good at like just zoning out and tuning into like running. I can do that forever, so that wasn't really the challenging part. It was more of just me wondering, like, am I gonna pass out? Like, is this gonna be dangerous if I don't have fuel? Like, if I do a fasted marathon and just, you know, don't have fuel on me? But nothing bad happens.
What's gonna happen is you're just gonna bonk and you're gonna go really slowly. That's what happened at my first marathon. At 30K, I was like, just like bonk. I just run, walk until I was past the
done.
That was horrible. But that's also a lesson, you know. But must be strange though. How is the sensation out on the street in New York now? Is it like
people who take it really seriously and people who don't, who act like nothing's going on, which is the weird thing. Like there are people who are really like abiding by all the social distancing rules and like wearing masks and stuff. But it's weird when you see the people who don't care and are just like, I don't know, making it a point to like feed on the fear. Like there was a woman when I was running, there was a woman with like no face cover. Like you're supposed to always have like a mask on or whatever, and I have my bandana on my face. But I saw her from across the street and she was just like making a scene and like pretending to cough on people, and I was like, this is kind of rude and scary. And I don't know, so I feel like it's mixed, but the sounds of like the ambulance, every time you hear an ambulance, it's very ominous versus like you always hear ambulances in New York, but like now it's like, because you know, okay, they're gonna probably go get someone, and it's scarier. And so
but isn't it strange when there's so few people out? I guess there's fewer people out than normal.
There are fewer people out. And in a weird way, like having the park, like I run a lot in one of the parks in Brooklyn, Prospect Park, and it's been emptier, which is great. So it's kind of nice to just be away. It doesn't feel like New York City because it's like you're not seeing as many people. And so, yeah, but the grocery store situation is the craziest part because there's lines that stand outside the, you know, with 6 feet markers of like having people waiting and waiting to get into grocery stores. But
is that what you do? You have to go to grocery store, or could you order stuff home and have it delivered?
You can. You can order, but usually it's like a wait. Like the waits are kind of weird with that stuff. I feel like sometimes it's like a day or two or something. But I've just like I'll go and stand in line, but. Yeah, it's not ideal in general. Like everything is just like a little bit more of a pain, but just hoping that it like we get through it.
It's going to get better at some point. We just hope sooner than later. Yeah. So I guess we've been through most of the things that I wrote down. I know there's a lot more to you. You have an Instagram account. You have a new Instagram account now. We are making Totoro memes. What do you say? Memes?
I was going to say, what's my new Instagram? Oh, yeah, that's it. Okay.
You did, right? It's like,
it's my meme account. It's like the only humor that I can, like, if I can just at least make a meme a day, I feel like I'm meme, okay and I'll be able to survive. Running. No, that's funny. Running in memes. But so I have that. Totoro Says meme account. My main Instagram my main Instagram is at Lucy the Viking, L-U-C-I-E the Viking. I just post my running stuff there usually, or like weird stories. I get kind of strange on the story. Like I tell people to just like mute my stories because I get a little nuts, but
but I think it's great because there's a sense of humor there. Some Instagrammers are really serious all the time, but I think it's funny that you can with stories you can do different stuff because they're gonna go away. So some strange dance or some strange pose or something. Yeah.
A lot of that,
I'm going to link to it. So the time with you is 4 o'clock. What do you do rest of the day now? You going to do anything?
So today I'm probably going to get trying to rally. And actually, I do need to go grocery shopping because I'm out of food, like bananas and stuff like that, like basics and tofu and whatever. Yeah. So I think I'm going to try to rally and go to the grocery store and make that be the like the big event. But I already did my run and felt great. I feel like it's just going to every day is just kind of like just get through it and don't have too many expectations and, you know.
But luckily, you live with a few friends, so you have some company around you. And
and like it's been really fun, like, you know, catching up on Netflix shows and just being lazy and stuff.
Yeah, I understand. Well, it is all right at some point or in the period to be a little bit lazy, eat some extra ice cream or chocolate.
Right, exactly. I know you like. That's what I've been doing.
But anything else you want to say that we should... put out?
I feel like the only thing I'd say is like my podcast is like all about my running adventures and my recovery adventures and just like funny stories of things that have happened in my life, but that's like my main outlet of like my diary. But my podcast and my Instagram.
How do you do you give them out regularly, or is it just when you feel like for it,
when I feel like telling a story? Because it's usually just me. Sometimes I interview friends and people that come into my life, but it's usually just like solos of storytelling.
I listen to a few. They're good. I think it's really hard to do the solo stuff. I never even tried. Even the intro stuff is really tough to do solo. Because just me sitting in a room talking to who, that's really weird. Right. But it's easier when you're going to introduce someone. But sometimes you just say a little bit what happened this week or how training is going or anything. But... anyway, it was really nice talking to you.
That was amazing. Thank you so much. And so you've had how many English episodes on your show?
I've only had two before.
Okay, so I'm the third English episode. I couldn't do anything in Norwegian because I wish I could speak Norwegian.
But. Yeah, I think I'm going to do the introduction in Norwegian actually because I noticed that even when I made the Sid Garza Hillman episode, there wasn't that many in the US listening. Even though he was talking about it on his podcast, he was like, this Norwegian was here. And yeah, here's a link to his blah, 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 and everything. And he talked
No, I'm psyched. I'm going to Norwegian podcast. Norwegian this is amazing.
Yeah, yeah, yeah. Yeah, there's a couple of thousand listening to it. So that's going to be a few. So I'll link to your stuff. And yeah, good luck with everything in the future, running and everything. And it's going to be nice to follow you and see what happens. Maybe we can have a chat when I come to New York at some point.
Definitely. Yeah. Definitely. You can come on my podcast.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. Okay. But thank you, Lucy, and have a great evening and everything. And we'll be talking soon, maybe.
Great. Thank you for having me. Bye. Yeah.
Bye-bye.
Det var Lucy. Det var morsomt det. Sjekk henne ut. Jeg legger link i podcastnotatene til websiden og Instagramen hennes. Og så oppfordrer dere igjen. Det gøy å snakke med fremmede. Start en podcast. Snakk med noen fremmede mennesker. Eller snakk om noe du har lyst til å dele med andre. Det en delingskultur. Det det vi lever i. Vi lever i en delingskultur. Jeg gir deg noe, du gir meg noe, du gir noen noe, noen gir deg noe. Det sånn det går rundt. Det merker vi jo nå at når ting stopper litt opp, så stopper det praktisk talt litt opp. Men når det sagt, det jo mulig å gjøre ting på egen hånd også, selvfølgelig. Ta deg litt tid til å lese en bok, lære noe, gå litt i dybden på noe. Samtidig så det ikke oppfordret. Jeg leste Morgenblad nå nylig. Så var vel Slavoj Žižek, som han heter, hvor han fra? Han er ikke tjekkisk, men han østeuropeer, han filosof. Det var et lite intervju med han i Morgenblad, hvor han sier at det kanskje ikke tiden for å dykke ned i det ytterste mørket. Så ja, kan stille meg bak til han. Det en tid for alt, så jeg oppfordrer jeg til å sjekke ut ting som ikke så enkelt å forstå, som filosofi og den menneskelige tilstand og sånne ting, men du trenger ikke å prøve å lese alt av Nietzsche akkurat nå. Det har ikke jeg gjort heller også, men jeg leser et par ting som ganske heavy noen ganger, bare for å undre meg litt over verdens tilstand og menneskets tilstand, ikke minst. Men samtidig så liker jeg også å bare se et eller annet underholdende på TV, Netflix, en film, et eller annet sånt, uten at jeg ser alt. Uten noe kritisk sans altså. Ser ikke så mye på ting, men en ting jeg har drevet med i disse ukene er å bakt mye surdeigsbrød. Det har vært kult, fordi jeg har vært egentlig selvforsynt på brød. Jeg har prøvd ut en del nye ting, prøvd å ekspandere litt. Kanskje når alt treffer veggen, så kan man starte et bakeri. Men vi får se. Uansett, kan anbefale surdeig. Hvis du blir Patreon nivå 2, så får du en surdeig start av meg. Får litt intro til å lage surdeigsbrød. Det veldig moro. Du slipper jo å gå og kjøpe gjær. Du kjører på villgjær. Og det det som smaker godt. Du kan jo heve ting over lang tid. Du kan blant annet blande en bakesats, holdt jeg på å si. Elte en deig, sette den over natten, putte den i form om morgenen og steke brød. Fersk brød til frokost. Det dødsdigg. Men nå kommer denne podcasten til å slutte. Og så kommer jeg til å ta dere enda lenger over USA-kontinentet neste uke. Jeg har en avtale med en i California. Han heter Sid Garza Hillman. Han har jeg snakket med på podcasten før. Så hvis du vil bli bedre kjent med han, så ligger en av mine første episoder der, episode 3 eller 4 og sånn, er med han. Da blir du kjent med han, ellers kan jeg linke til den i podcastnotaten og hans podcast og litt sånn, hvis du vil vite litt om bakgrunnen. Det kan bli gøy, så inntil videre, kjør på, løp, trenger ikke å stresse for tiden med løpingen, bare hold det gående inntil vi kan sette en dato for når vi skal gjøre noe morsomt sammen igjen. Det gleder jeg meg til, veldig gleder meg til det. Ok. Ha en fantastisk dag videre.